your people. Your people. They are my people now. I hold their whole world in my power. You're a fool. You're a fool. I'll send you to your beloved goddess Amdo to discuss the future of the universe with her. You. You demand. You demand? Well, since your beloved goddess has developed such an enchanting appetite for people, it's only fitting that the great Thous should offer himself. No, no. I shall offer him. Kill those two men. Nothing in the world can stop me now. Hello, and thank you for downloading the Trap One podcast. Today we are all about dramatic readings of Joseph First's famous monologue from The Underwater Menace, which is recently out on animated Blu-ray in both color and black and white. One of my favorite movies is Glengarry Glen Ross, which is a tale of a boiler room of crooked real estate agents in Brooklyn. The stage play took place in Chicago, but the movie version was relocated here to South Brooklyn. And Alec Baldwin has a movie-only cameo as a motivational speaker who's trying to get these salesmen to do a better job of selling non-existent real estate. And he does this five-minute monologue in the movie that's pretty famous. He's come back on Saturday Night Live to spoof it over the years. On the DVD of the movie, there is an extra feature where they hired a bunch of drama students to perform the same monologue. None of the drama students were able to match the intensity of Alec Baldwin. It's almost impossible to do. If you give somebody a monologue that good, only a genius actor is able to bring it to life. My thesis, guys, and I'll introduce you in a moment, my thesis is that Joseph First's monologue at the Episode 3 cliffhanger to Underwater Menace is one of Classic Who's shining moments. This has been misunderstood and misinterpreted and derided over the years, when the only way that we could see the story was an nth generation off-air copy of Episode 3 in isolation. Now that we know what we're looking at, and now that we have the whole story reasonably complete, I think this is one of the best acting performances in the show, because if you're given a monologue like this, you could do a straight reading like I just did, and it may be acceptable, but it's kind of dull, kind of flat. It takes a Joseph First to turn that monologue into alchemical gold, and I think that's exactly what he did. So would my panel please introduce themselves, and then we'll debate the topic.
Well, hello, I'm Cy.
And I am Professor Frieseroff.
I'm going to start off, and you guys have all been on Doctor Who Literature with me. What I've been doing lately over on DW Lit is I've been asking the three questions from Darren Mooney's excellent Ireland-based movie podcast, The 250. He asks all of his guests for any given week the same three questions about every movie, and his podcast is based on the IMDb list of the 250 greatest movies of all time, as voted on by IMDb users. Fraser went over this with me a couple of weeks ago when we covered the two Doctors on Doctor Who Lit, but I think it's appropriate to ask about The Underwater Menace in the same vein. So, Cy, does Underwater Menace belong on a list of one of the 60 greatest Doctor Who stories of all time?
Not quite, but it deserves a higher placing than it ever gets.
Where did this story rank the last time DWM did a top-to-bottom survey of the entire Doctor Who canon?
It was pretty low, from what I remember. I can't remember exactly, but I think it was second to last favourite Troughton story, so it was not well received, even to this day.
On the 2014 DWM survey, Underwater Menace is ranked 224 out of 241. There are only two Troughton stories that are below it, so this was considered the third worst Troughton story, and one of the bottom 20 Doctor Who's of all time. Fraser, would you like to take a guess which two Troughton stories were ranked below The Underwater Menace?
One of them must be The Space Pirates.
Yes, number 235, The Space Pirates is only slightly better than Underworld.
And the other one must be The Crotons, because people have strange tastes like that.
I'll give you a hint. This list is printed upside down, as somebody once said.
Well, if you flip it upside down, then obviously the Dominators comes top, but that no one would, in their right mind, would vote that as low. you know, especially on a podcast with two such big fans like me and you, Jason.
What impresses me is that Dominators is not even the worst Troughton story of all time. Space Pirates is one tick below it. Dominators is 234. But Fraser, does Underwater Menace belong on a list of the 60 best Doctor Who stories on TV of the last 60 years?
At the risk of repeating what I said on Doctor Who Literature, I think it will appear on someone's list, not mine. But I agree with what Simon had said. You know, for 240 or whatever it's appeared, that is scandalous. And it is a lot higher up than there. So it's probably nudging 60-ish for me, but it wouldn't make the top 60 because there's a lot of other excellent stories out there.
Which segues to the second question. And for this question, I preface that best and favorite are two different things. Would Underwater Menace, Fraser, be on your own personal list of your 60 favorite Doctor Who stories of all time, especially for comfort viewing purposes?
Possibly. I mean, when I did my list, I sort of merged the two together. I didn't quite say best and I didn't quite say favourite. I just kind of got a random preference revealer and went with a snap decision over which one out of the two. So it wasn't quite favourite, it wasn't quite best. Favourite it could well be, because ultimately, I mean, this is a story that has got no right to work. You know, the plot stands up to absolutely no scrutiny whatsoever. The characters are driven by motivations completely unknown to anyone. They just do things for random plot reasons. You've got a leading man who's finding his way into the role. You've got a supporting actor who's coming in as a regular who's, you know, thrown in at the last minute and is also trying to find his way into the role. You've got a production team who are trying to find their way into the role. The show has been moved around the schedules. It's lost one director because it thought it was too unambitious and it was never going to be realised on the BBC Doctor Who budget. So it's got no right to actually work, but it works. It works fantastically well. You put those four episodes on and they are entertaining. They are really fascinating and likeable and enjoyable 25-minute portions of Doctor Who. So yeah, I think it might, if I was just doing favourite only, I think it would have a very good chance of getting in there.
I think I fall into your way of thinking. When I did my own top 60 list, and by the time this episode drops, I either will be at Galley 1 in Los Angeles or will have just come back from Galley 1 in Los Angeles. And I am moderating on the Friday afternoon the Doctor Who 60 for 60 panel under the Deathmatch annual feature at Galley 1. This is my first time appearing on the Deathmatch and moderating, and it's going to be 60 for 60. It is not on my own personal list, but since we're going to have 10 panelists, I am hoping that somebody will have it on there, because I think for me it is comfort viewing. I got the Nth Generation copy of Episode 3 at some point in the mid-90s when I was still in college. Then, you know, those Nth Generation copies, you couldn't hear everything and the video was wavy, and the Episode 2 cliffhanger reprise, Noel Johnson's dialogue from Episode 2 cliffhanger is so faint that people thought for a while that it was talkback from the gallery. But no, it is in fact Noel Johnson speaking the dialogue that ends Episode 2. Sigh. Fraser and I enjoy the story. It's not quite on our top 60, but we think an argument could be made. Is this on your own list of your 60 favorite Doctor Whos?
No, but it has risen up hugely since the animation, really. So it's a story I have come to appreciate a lot more. Like yourself, I had a copy of this sort of fairly early on, about 1990, I think. And I thought, well, the episode 3, anyway, and a suspiciously good copy as well, so it wasn't an nth degree one, which was a bit of a surprise. But I always really enjoyed episode 3, but out of context, it's very hard to extrapolate the rest of the story from that one episode. And I think because Joseph First's performance is so big, that's what people latched onto, and it's a magnificent performance. But you need to see the build up to the "nothing in the world can stop me now" that you don't get when you've just got the third episode. You need that build up from episode 1 and all the way through to that, because that's him cracking and going completely insane. It's a story that when episode 2 was discovered, suddenly you get a bit more of the pieces together and you say, oh, okay, so this is what's happening. And you can almost visibly see Troughton working out that if he's going to be facing off against a great big over-the-top villain or actor who's coming in and playing it large, then he can't play it large as well. So he's got to take his performance right down. And it's almost like tangible in those scenes with Joseph Furst, where he's thinking, right, so this is, oh, I need to do this. Oh, okay, right, I see how this is going to be now. Right, I've got it. And you can see the performance sort of coming together. So it's sort of been a gradual process. And then hearing the full audio made a bit more sense. But I think the animation has really crystallized the whole story for me in a way that it hasn't before. Because, I mean, fair play to the DVD. They put it out when it wasn't expected. But the Telesnap reconstruction was clumsy at best.
Right. And that same Telesnap is available on the Blu-ray, but of course there are multiple ways to watch the story on the Blu-ray. We'll come to that in a moment. But you make a really interesting point, Si, about the evolution of Patrick Troughton's Doctor, because he started off, he was doing costumes, he was doing accents. His original catchphrase is heard for the final time in this story, "I would like a hat like that."
Yeah.
The very next story after this, the Moonbase, is the story where he becomes the Troughton Doctor that we think of, the Doctor who is quiet, who doesn't say anything, and then suddenly pops up at the very end, and you realize he was paying attention and working to his own design in the background the whole time. Whereas in this story, dressing up as a, I hesitate to use the word, but it's in the camera script, a gypsy figure, and playing the recorder and blowing pepper into Zaroff's face and putting on accents, this is the last time he does that. And maybe you could make an argument that working through this story is what convinced him to change his entire style. So the real Second Doctor begins in the story immediately after this one. Speaking of production notes, so the production team had completely gone off the rails at this point, and they were down to a 6-day turnaround. Episodes were taped on Sunday night and aired the following Saturday. So this is one of my favorite points of Doctor Who. When you turn on the TV, that's Saturday night, and I think we're in February 1967 now, and you watch Professor Zaroff in the Episode 3 cliffhanger, at the moment that the cliffhanger airs for the very first time, they had not filmed the resolution to Part 4. That didn't get filmed until the next night. If anything had happened to Joseph Furst in between recording that cliffhanger and the following week, they never would have been able to make or finish episode 4 of this story. That is insane. And we know now from the audio commentary on the DVD moderated by Toby Haydock that Patrick Troughton did not like director Julia Smith and she never came back to work on the show again. It's a bit unclear as to why, because I think she does an incredible job with what she has. But you have a Doctor clashing with the director and the director loses. And this happens time and again in the history of Doctor Who, but it's interesting that it happens so early on in Troughton's tenure. So the third question, and I'll go back to Si on this one. If on the off chance that a listener to the Trap One podcast has never seen Underwater Menace, do you recommend that they stop the tape, stop the recording, go out and order the Blu-ray, wait for the Blu-ray to arrive, watch the color version of the animation, watch the black and white animation, and watch the telesnaps and the audio commentaries and the making of featurette, and then come back and listen to the rest of the show to join in the discussion?
Yes, I would. Although I would say maybe you could just watch one version and that would probably be okay, because I'm not insane and I'm not horrible and I'm not expecting you to sit through three versions of the same thing before you listen to this. Although hopefully a lot of people will have done.
And Fraser, same question. Do you recommend that listeners stop listening to this episode, put it on pause, stream the Underwater Menace to a local device, and then come back and listen to the rest of the show to appreciate the nuance?
No, I'm going to go with the first option of buying the Blu-ray. This is the review of the Blu-ray set, so if people haven't already got that, then yeah, they might be listening to us thinking, oh, well, I'm going to listen to this podcast and see if they recommend it. Well, I recommend it. I think it's great. But yes, and I'm going to fly in the face of Simon there and say, yeah, watch all versions. You know, I always watch the black and white version first because I like to enjoy things as nature intended. Then I'll watch the colour. On this one, obviously, we've got the two remaining episodes, so you can, you know, watch around. I don't usually do telly snaps. I don't do static pictures very well, so telly snaps really don't work for me. But I did put the episode one telly snap version on today to watch that, which was interesting because there's a few subtle differences in, you know, what's on the animation as to what's on the telly snap. Well, one of them was quite explainable because the Doctor loses his hat quite quickly, which was disappointing because, much like the Doctor, I am a fan of hats and I would like a hat like that as well. So watching the telly snap, I realised that he kept his hat for quite a way through. And it's one of these things that you always associate with Troughton is the stovepipe hat, which he only wore for like two stories and then got rid of. So to see it, you know, quite the way through episode one in the telly snaps was like, well, why didn't you put that in? And but obviously it's got to do with, you know, animation budgets and whatnot. The second thing I picked up on was the change the wording on the note in part one.
Yes, I noticed that as well. Because on the note, he signs himself basically as Doctor Who.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in the original broadcast version, you know, it says something along the lines of a terrible secret will die with me, signed Doctor W. Whereas in the animation, it just says, I have a secret. And I thought, well, wow. I can understand not wanting to animate a hat, but what difference does it make if you if you don't have the full note there? So that was a little bit strange. So if you're one of those people who likes to notice these things, then yes, go and watch all the versions together. So, you know, because I've watched the black and white, I've watched the colour version, I've watched the remaining episodes, and I've watched one of the telly snaps. So from my point of view, go do that. Don't stream it. Go buy the physical media.
And of course, we are promoting the physical media here. We are big physical media people. We review all DVDs as they come out. Strongly encourage everyone to buy it, even if it's not one of your favorite stories. I think the DVDs will open your eyes to the story and make you appreciate it in a way you never have before. And we want the production team to make more of these animations and release more episodes on Blu-ray. So buying it is always a good thing if you are in a consumer position to do that. Si, which version of the story did you choose to watch?
I watched the colour version because I'm a heathen and always watch the colour versions and rarely watch the black and white ones, because I feel, from the point of view of the animators, that they are making this in colour 69 as their starting point rather than the black and white one. So that's the version that feels like the one that I should watch if I'm going to watch these. So I always do the colour one first. And I did do the whole of the colour one and then went back and watched the two live action episodes afterwards. So I haven't seen the black and white version and I possibly never will.
I am also, and I fall somewhere in between you two guys, as I do in real life. When I was doing my pilgrimage between October 2020 and November 2021 for my now deleted Twitter account, I did not choose to watch any of the color animations. And a lot of the color animations came out in the middle of my pilgrimage. So I watched Macro Terror and Faceless Ones and Fury from the Deep, all as black and white animations. I was doing the pilgrimage not only to enjoy Doctor Who during the pandemic and tweet about it, but also to get a sense for the visual evolution of the show. And I thought that watching full budget color animations in the middle of black and white 405 line videotape and telesnaps would get in the way of my project. Now that I am done with the pilgrimage, when I did Galaxy 4, on which I think I was also part of the Trap 1 panel, and for this, I chose to watch the color first, but I watched each episode twice back to back over a span of 4 days. I watched the color animation first, and then I immediately had to swap discs because the color is on disc two. The telesnap reconstructions and the surviving video is also on the other disc. So I had to switch discs twice every day. But I watched either the recon or the live action episode with the Toby Hadoke commentary, and he has different people in the booth. He has a Michael Trouton interview for episode one, and Michael Trouton gives some interesting insights into what motivated his dad, including some things that I wish I hadn't known, but it's a nice warts and all look. And then he has a lot of the surviving cast and crew for episodes two and three, followed by archival interviews sampled throughout episode four. So that way I was able to watch both the animation and either the Telesnap reconstruction, which points out that the hat is a lot more present on television than it was in the animation, because they don't have the money to animate a hat popping up and down for 90 minutes of TV time. But you also get a sense of what the animation doesn't capture. And there are some parts of the story that I think don't work on animation once you've seen the live video first. Julia Smith is an excellent visual director. The Ballet of the Fish People, considering the budget under which it was made and the time constraints under which it was made, basically live to tape, I think it's a remarkable achievement. And the fact that we could only see it as a blurry nth generation copy for so long led people to make fun of it. But I think it is worthy of praise rather than scorn. Absolutely. Annika Wills is fighting back at the episode one cliffhanger as the guy from House of Cards is trying to perform this horrible surgery on her. I think her fighting back is much more vivid in live action once you see Annika Wills. And if you watch it on animation, where she appears to be docilely walking towards her doom, it doesn't quite work. And then the last big change that I noticed, I'll pull you guys on this in a minute. In episode two, the Doctor is talking to House of Cards guy, Colin Jeavons. And on TV, he is very busy with his hands. He is working with test tubes. He's working with a handkerchief. And as he's interrogating Colin Jeavons about his fish people surgery, he's also doing this bit of business with his hands. On the animation, you can hear him clinking glass and waving things around. But on the animation, his hands are stock still and he's not moving. So he then pulls a test tube and throws it on the ground and it blows up and he knocks Damon out. He's able to run away and escape. That's a beautiful sequence on the live action, but they are not able to animate that given that it's 2D animation and they don't have much of a budget or time. So that sequence doesn't work because you can hear physical business on the soundtrack, but you can't see it on the animation. So I think the animation is a bit of a pale cousin to the live action. Also, lastly, the set design. The sets are packed full of goodies. The sets are visually interesting. There's paintings on the walls. The camera is really close in because Lime Grove D was very, very tiny, and the camera was never more than a couple of inches from the actor. The camera for the animation is all the way back, so when you're looking at it, everything is small, and the sets are very clean and not cluttered, and the walls are plain. The only big upgrade for the animation is that they took Tom Watson, who plays a weak-chested, shirtless Ramo, and they recast him as Jason Momoa, complete with tribal tattoos. So I want to ask you guys, and I want to be very fair. People work very hard on this. It's not their fault that they don't have a Walt Disney-style animation budget. Walt Disney was able to do much more sophisticated work than this in Snow White. Snow White, he choreographs 30 animals on screen at the same time. You just can't do that for this type of limited animation. So this is not a knock on the animators at all. They are literally doing the best they can. But does the story work better for you half live action, half telesnap? Does it work better as an animation? Do you think we should get more animations for missing stories, knowing that they're never going to be able to recapture the alchemy of Patrick Troughton 6 inches away from a studio camera, always working with his hands?
What I like about this animation particularly is that although there are those problems and the budget is obviously a problem, as a whole, it works really, really well because you get into that world. Sometimes sort of doing it piecemeal, like I did tonight, I did animated the two episodes and then the animated episode for part four. And I think if you watch the whole animation, you get a good solid overview of the whole story and it's all of one. But darting in and out of the two different versions, I think sort of takes away from what the pluses of the animation have been. Sort of cast out of that world a bit and sort of trying to sort of get back. So I don't think it quite works sort of doing it that way for me, not with this one anyway. But I liked the way that this one was animated, and I liked the style, and I liked the character designs, and I liked the set designs, and I was swept up in that. And I know that it's different to what they did in the live action, but that's fine. That works for me, and I think this one was a bit of a triumph overall.
And I will say the color scheme is, and I said the same thing for Galaxy 4, the color scheme is delightful. These things are a visual feast for the eyes because they're using period 60s color scheme, and it just looks great because color animation no longer looks like this. So it's really nice to have as a period piece. Fraser, same question for you. Would you rather watch this as half recon, half surviving footage, or would you rather watch this as a Technicolor animation and pretend that we don't have the originals or half the originals to fall back on?
I mean, regardless of your budget, regardless of whether you are, you know, Disney, Marvel, Sony, you know, whether you're sort of Pixar level of animation or whether you're sort of like, you know, Ubisoft and the stuff they can do on computer games nowadays, you are never going to get close to the live action version. That's always going to be the standard. That's always going to be the top one because you get, like you say, you get sort of what people are doing with the hands, you get what people are doing with the faces, you get all of that stuff, you get what people are doing in the background. You're never going to be able to do that on animation, no matter how good you are, no matter how much money you got. So that's kind of a lost cause. In terms of, you know, the animation, do I prefer the black and white in the colour? I think it very much depends on the story, to be honest. I think this story didn't really offer as much in terms of the colour version. I think there were some nice little touches. I think the sort of skin tone of the Atlanteans was a nice touch because that was very sort of grey and fish-like, to be honest, which is what you would expect from a society which is subterranean. They've got no access to the light, so they are going to look that respect. And then sort of like you had really like red and vivid orange and green fish people, which didn't really work for us. I prefer the old design of the fish people. So my preference is for the black and white version because I think that works better in that setting. In terms of the sets, you know, you're absolutely right, Jason, what you're saying in that, you know, Lime Grove or wherever the film, this one was compact, and there's that brings that sort of busyness to the market scene where we've got Patrick Troughton in his disguise. I would say blind beggar in the style of Robin Hood, quite fitting for Patrick Troughton. That's what that brought me to mind. But that scene where you've got a very, you know, small space with a lot of people in it, you know, that really works well. When you kind of expand it outwards, in the Amdur throne room with the big statue, you know, it's pluses and minuses to that because the compact set, you know, really has a sense of kind of claustrophobia about it, and it really it's more sort of tangible. But realistically speaking, it would have been a bigger set, and you wouldn't have, you know, Ben opening a little trap door that no one has ever found before to, you know, beckon the doctor in, which, you know, when the doctor stood right next to, is it Thaus or Ramo or, you know, and manages to sneak past him just because he's got his head down, that doesn't really work well in the live version. It works much better in the animation because there's that sense of distance and actually, you know, he's not right next to him. So, I mean, there's pluses and minuses to both. I think the beauty, though, is that whatever's your poison, you've got it. You know, if you want to watch the telly snaps and you want to watch the existing footage and you're not really interested in the animation, then you can still do that because ultimately you've got those two episodes scrubbed up for Blu-ray.
And you are correct, Fraser, by the way. They did not move into Lime Grove D until the end of Moonbase the following month. This was, and I'm checking my friend Shannon Patrick Sullivan's website, Brief History of Time Travel. This was shot at Riverside 1. Riverside 1 was bigger than Lime Grove D, but not by much. So I still say that the set designers, the production team, had to cram in things to make the sets visually interesting.
And they
you do.
And
you do lose
it. It really works. I mean, like I say, that marketplace is really realistic, and you know, you feel like you're there. You feel like you're actually sitting on the edge of the fountain yourself.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people there for a 60 story, so it feels buzzy and busy all the time, and there's people moving around in the foreground and the background, which gives it a sense of depth.
Yep. And I think, like you say, Jason, the standout scene for this whole story is the fish ballet, you know, with Dudley's, you know, really quite experimental for him score, you know, with the fish people swimming around. I mean, that's stunning. That's a stunning bit of television for the 60s. You know, I think that was shot at Ealing, and you can show they've got a lot more space to play with, and they've got the wires and whatnot. And, you know, Julia Smith really goes to town and really produces something that is possibly one of the best scenes in all of Doctor Who. You know, I'm not just being contrary saying that. I really think, you know, when I watched that for the first time, I remember being really struck with how amazing all of that came together. The choreography and the soundtrack and whatnot, and you know, it's just fish people passing message on to other fish people in silence. It really, really works. So like I say, coming back to the original question, whatever you want to do, if you want to watch the telly snaps, if you want to watch black and white mixed in with the original footage, if you want to put the colour on for episode one, put the the original on for episode two. If you want to watch the animation in black and white for three and go back to colour for four, you can do it. You know, it's one of the things that kind of irritates us about the complaints about the animations not being true to the original vision of the show. Is that, one, you're not going to get that. You're never going to get that, no matter how much money you've got. Two, you're not losing anything by this. You're not losing anything by having this animation. You know, if you don't like a colour animation, you know, if you are like a bit more of a purist than me, if you want to see it all in black and white, you've got that. You know, if, you know, like Simon, you know, you're looking at this as like a brand new piece of work, you know, a real interpretation of this story, which I think is where we're at now with the animations. We're not just plugging gaps. I think we are getting new versions of stories from some creative people. Then, you know, you've got that as well. You're not losing anything at all through this, so just, you know, enjoy the extra that you're getting. Rant over.
So speaking of interpretation, Fraser, it is now your turn. I have placed in our recording software chat window the Professor Zaroff monologue to end episode 3. I have removed all of the interjections from Noel Johnson's character and the stage directions. We have a monologue and a half, and we're all going to do it. I started it at the cold open. Now it's Fraser's turn. You are now going to perform for us Professor Zaroff's famous episode 3 end of cliffhanger direct to camera rant.
Right, so I'll try not to do the Jenny Laird version, but I am going to have to try and keep it in a little bit because my kids are in bed asleep, so I don't want to wake them up by going full first. So, Mark, if you can just get Conrad to record this and then edit it in over my top bit, that'll be lovely. So.
Brilliant.
Right, I once hired Conrad to do my voiceovers on Doctor Who Lit the week that I had COVID and couldn't speak. So we know that Conrad is phenomenal at this, but I think doing Jason is a little bit easier than doing Joseph first.
Well, let's see how we get on. So, your people, you're my people now. I hold the whole world in my power. You're a fool! I'll send you to your beloved goddess Amdo to discuss the future of the universe with her. You demand? Well, since your beloved goddess has developed such an enchanting appetite for people, it's only fitting that the great Thaus should offer himself. No, I shall offer him. Kill those two men. Nothing in the world can stop me now!
So that's interesting, because when I did it, I intentionally decided not to do it anywhere close to the way that Joseph first did it. I was trying to do it as a more serious monologue, like you might find in a TV drama. I was not trying to go as over the top as Joseph first. I'm not capable of that. Fraser, I think, was very close to the Joseph First style on that, so that was impressive. The way that he almost laughed in the middle of some of these sentences. Now we're going to come back and we're going to have Sai's interpretation at the very end. And I'm very curious to hear how Sai is going to interpret this. There's a lot of elements to this story that I think bear discussion, and not just Professor Zaroff. If I were to ask you which Doctor Who story featured a man of faith as an important secondary character who teams up with the Doctor and has his faith shattered along the way and becomes a doubter, and then at the very end tries to recapture his faith and is killed for his efforts at the episode 3 cliffhanger, which Doctor Who story would you say that is, and which character would you say that is?
Well, I'd say that was the Curse of Fenric and the Reverend Wainwright.
And that is exactly what I was going for. That was one of my favorite characters, I think Nicholas Parsons. And bear in mind, I'm coming from the States, so I didn't know about his other work. I didn't know that this was out of character for him. I thought he gave a terrific, worried and concerned and very dramatic and compelling performance. What I didn't know until episode 2 of this story was recovered over a dozen years ago now, Tom Watson as Ramo is doing the exact same character, but he's not doing it in a story like Curse of Fenric, in which Wainwright is the most important character in the piece and gets the most important dialogue. He's doing it in a script where no two actors are on the same page as how they are supposed to read these lines. So I think Tom Watson kind of gets lost in the shuffle. Fraser, not counting Zaroff and not counting the regulars, who do you think is the best actor in this piece, or gives the best performance in this piece?
I'm tempted to say Fish Person number one, but I think that's a little bit tricky. I think we've got some good ones. Obviously, you've mentioned Colin Jevons there is it Damon?
Damon? Yes.
I like, is it Jacko? Who's the Irish?
Yes, Jacko, yes.
Is he the Irish one?
No, Sean is the Irish one, and Jacko is the one from the Indies, the West Indies.
Yeah, so Sean, you know, it's quite a very stereotypical Irishman with the gift of the gab, talking the fish people into mutiny in less than 90 seconds. But that's a good performance. Ara as well, I like. I'm terrible at people's names. Who played Ara?
That's Catherine Howe, I think. She was on the Blu-ray commentary for episodes 2 and 3.
Yeah, I'm going to go with her because I think, you know, that's a very underwritten and very underappreciated role, which she actually brings a lot to. I think, you know, as the Atlantean serving girl who, you know, falls in with the Doctor and their friends, it's a thankless task, but I think she does bring some real warmth and depth to that.
I think I would agree with Fraser. I think Catherine Howe is really, really good. She was one of sort of the outstanding characters for me as well. But I do like Thaus a lot as well. I think he's played really well by Noel Johnson, who comes back later to Doctor Who and is Sir Charles Grover in Invasion of the Dinosaurs, which is a very different performance indeed. And I think he's quite dignified, and despite the costume and the hat or headdress that he is lumbered with, I think he does really well at sort of this fairly world weary king who's been promised the world by Zaroff and becomes completely disenchanted by the end of it and realizes he's been taken for a fool. I think that's a really nice performance. It's nice also to see Cyril from Celestial Toymaker back as Lolum, giving a suitably over-the-top performance as well. So, that's a delight. But, Colin Jevons as well, I think, is never bad and should have had a much bigger role in Doctor Who than this and K-9 and Company. I think he deserved a proper villainous role or a proper friend role. He would have been really fantastic. And it's a bit of a waste.
You can't see it as well on the animation because the director has toned it down. The eyebrows that Colin Jeavons is wearing as Damon are basically a character in and of themselves.
That was going to be my second choice.
Colin Jeavons' eyebrows?
Colin Jeavons' eyebrows, yeah.
And Cy brings up a great point about Noel Johnson. Charles Grover in Invasion of the Dinosaurs is a terrific performance because he starts off as an ally and then it turns out that he's the bad guy, the big bad. But even as the big bad, he is sympathetic and understandable because he tries to save Sarah Jane. He tries to give her a new life on that fake spaceship. He's clearly not as evil as the Peter Miles character, Professor Whitaker, because nobody did evil better than Peter Miles. But Charles Grover is, even as the bad guy, you're kind of rooting for him to get what he wants, which I guess he does in a way. This performance is basically, he's trying to do a Shakespearean King, but in a performance where no two actors are on the same page as to how to read these lines. So he unfortunately has to share most of his screen time with Joseph first. And as a straight man, I don't think it's quite as good. Whereas he gets the much meatier part later on in Invasion of the Dinosaurs, for sure. I was a little disappointed that Peter Stevens is only in episodes 1 and 3. Have you guys read the Nigel Robinson novelization of this?
Yes, but not for a long time.
I have not, no.
It is coming up on Doctor Who Literature probably within the next 6 months. I am in between books 103 and 104 right now. And Underwater Menace is book 129, but I have a few interstitial books in the middle, like the Companions book, so probably about 6 months away. And somebody very close to the Trap One community will be my guest for the Underwater Menace book. If anybody on this recording is going to be the guest in that episode but doesn't want the ending of the book spoiled, this might be a good time for them to walk away for a couple of minutes. But for everybody else, Nigel Robinson watches the surviving bits of episode 4, because we do have, via the censor, we have Zaroff's death scene. I don't know if that was available when
we
Nigel
didn't
Robinson
have that at the
this.
Time, though. Not in 87.
But at the very least, he may have been able to hear the off-air soundtrack, and he certainly would have read the script. The ending of the story is frustrating because Zaroff has this switch that's going to destroy the world, and it's a classic Doctor Who trope. The plot is resolved by the pushing, or in this case, non-pushing of a single button. They manage to lower the shield and flood the room so that he's not able to get through the compartment and flick the switch that'll end the world. On TV, he spends about 5 minutes trying to reach through the bars to touch a button that's 30 feet away from the bars, and he can't do it, and he drowns just standing there trying to reach through the bars. Nigel Robinson quickly realizes this is not going to work, and he rewrites the ending of the story so that in the novelization, Lolum comes back, and the book becomes a literal fight between the forces of evil science, Zaroff, and the forces of evil superstition, Lolum, and they fight to the death as the room is flooding. So instead of Zaroff getting locked in a room like the scientists in the movie version of Westworld, there's an actual action-packed climax, and we find out what happens to Lolum. Whereas on TV, the last time we see him is getting bamboozled by Polly as the voice of Amdo in episode 3, and it makes him quite a foolish character. But I like the idea that in the book, he goes down swinging and fighting Zaroff for ruining his dreams. So if you come to the book first and then watch the TV second, the TV ending is quite a disappointment. What did you guys think about the staging of Zaroff's death on the animation? Because bear in mind, we can, of course, see the surviving censor footage now and compare it.
I would like to say kudos to my friend Scott Gray for coming up with the idea of the octopus getting close to the lever, looking like he's about to pull the lever, and then swimming off, which I think is absolute genius and made me howl with laughter the first time. Because obviously, that's something that they couldn't do on TV. There is no way they were going to get an octopus and stage that. So that's where the animation comes into its own. It's extrapolating what they might have done and could have done if they'd had time and resources and everything else. And I think that was brilliant and added something to those, particularly that last bit of sort of bubbling under the water. Obviously, it's not accurate to 1967, but when it's a good joke like that, I think that works really, really well. So, and much better than seeing Zaroff's hair floating off as he as he comes down into the water. It looks like his wig is about to go flying away, sort of in the center clip that we've got. So, yeah, you know, I think they did a sterling job with something where there's just a lot of sound effects and not a lot to go on. So, yeah, well done, Scott. Loved that.
And giving full credit to Julia Smith, just having an actor drown in an enormous tank full of water in December 1966 is an achievement for television in and of itself. There's no room to both have the drowning effect in a huge tank of water and a fist fight with Peter Stevens. I think it works well for what it is, but it doesn't work anymore. So that's a good use of changing the camera scripts for the animated version, because you're allowed to do sight gags like that, which give the audience something to latch onto. That's a positive change.
Yeah, I think that kind of just goes back to what we were saying before. This isn't someone else's interpretation of the story, isn't it? You know, was it Neil Robinson, did you say, did the...
Nigel Robinson.
Yeah. So, you know, we've got the target, just as the target novelization is Nigel Robinson's interpretation of this story, the animation is the animator's version of the story. So this is another place where I fall down when people start criticizing the changes on the animations as well. You know, if you are going to lambast View from the Deep or The Underwater Menace or The Abominable Snowmen for not being 100% accurate to what was on screen, are you then going to do the exact same with the target? Because no single target that I've read so far has been 100% faithful. There has always been, you know, changes and additions and fleshings out and whatnot. So, you know, that's my kind of way of looking at this now. These animations now is not, you know, like I say, but we're plugging a gap. This is just another version of the story. So I think that's a really good example of that in place.
We're reaching the end of our time together. Did you walk away from the Blu-ray with a new appreciation of or a greater enjoyment of the story? And to the extent that you keep mental rankings of all Doctor Who from A to Z, or as we would say here in Brooklyn, from A to Z, did you walk away from this Blu-ray saying, this is the definitive version of Underwater Menace, and I like the story much better than I did previously? Starting with Fraser and then going over to Cy.
It's an improvement on what I've seen so far, because, like I say, tally snaps don't really work for me. I like to have things moving. So, you know, to have moving pictures, regardless of what they look like, is always a kind of step up for me. Has it made me enjoy the story more? I don't think it has, if I'm being honest. I think, you know, I loved the story going in to it. It's one of the reasons, as soon as it was announced, I was knocking on Mark's door saying, please, if you need anyone for the panel, hello. So, and you know, I've enjoyed it, the two existing episodes and the Telly Snap version. So having the animation just means I can enjoy it a lot easier, but I still enjoy it quite a lot. Do I think it's the definitive version? Well, I would like to have had a bit more behind the scenes, because I sense there's a lot went in behind the scenes on this. You know, we've got like the making of documentary there, which kind of touches on quite a few things, but I think there's potentially a lot more to the making of this story. So I would have liked a bit more in that respect. I suspect there's probably more in the commentaries that I'm missing, because I haven't listened to those. So that might be a plan to go back and listen to those commentaries and pick that up that way. It's just another in a succession of great bits of merchandise for us Doctor Who fans. I've got the Steelbook version. I don't know what about you guys. I've got the Steelbook version.
It's gorgeous, isn't it? I love the Steelbooks of all the animations.
Yeah, that's just continuing the line of absolutely stunning artwork and, you know, really nice things to have on your shelf or on your coffee table or whatever. So it's wonderful. You know, I'm really glad that I've went out and got this one.
Whereas I have the US release of Underwater Menace, so it is a blue plastic Blu-ray clamshell, and it's smaller in size than the regular DVD, which I turned around and sold on eBay once I had the Blu-ray, because all the special features from the 10-year-old cheap DVD have now been reproduced on this one. Cy, same question for you. Did this augment your appreciation of the story? Did you walk away feeling differently? And is this the definitive version of Underwater Menace?
Well, the fact remains, although it's highly entertaining, this is a story about a man who hasn't invented a fridge. And it's fundamentally a bit of a problem when he's coming from post-1968, when fridges were invented, and he could pop up in his big elevator and collect a couple of fridges or freezers to store food in, and this would have sorted everything out. All his people relations would have been sorted out completely by that one fundamental thing that he's not thought of. But that's a classic villain thing, that you don't have the overview of everything and you're so focused on what you're doing that you don't think about fridges for your food. So that becomes sort of ever more crystal clear every time I watch it, and that does make me laugh. But I think, to answer your question, this is the definitive version so far, until we get episode 1 and 4 back, which maybe one day we will. Then obviously the proper live action version will always be the one that was recorded in 1966-67 will always be the version of this story. But for now, we've got a fully animated version that we didn't expect, that we thought the range was cancelled, and they pulled this out of the hat, and I'm very pleased to have it on the shelf, and very pleased that I can sit and watch it and enjoy it and get swept along with a fast and funny, and it is surprisingly funny, story at times as well. So whether that's intentional or not, I think there's a lot to enjoy in this story.
And from my part, this serial aired exactly 56 years ago. We have had 56 years to figure out the plot holes and make fun of the story illogic. Hooray. Great. You've had 56 years to shoot the fish in a barrel. Happy hunting. When I watch a Doctor Who story, the first time it's about plot. The second time it's about catching the subtext and continuity bits that I missed. When I'm watching a story for the 8th time, and I think I'm up to that with Underwater Menace, including all the times that I watched my off-air Nth Generation episode 3 copy 30 years ago, I'm not watching it for the plot anymore. I don't care about the plot holes. I am watching it for the style and tone and design. When you watch a black and white Doctor Who 56 years later, you are dealing with genius level stage actors like Troughton and Hartnell, who always found a way to be interesting with their body language. Mm-hmm. Even though these stories are shot on 6 sets live to tape and there are flubs and it's a tiny studio, whether it's Riverside or Lime Grove, the actors know how to keep the camera occupied at all times. The costumes are great. The set design is frenetic. These are very crowded labs, and there's paintings on the walls. There's always something to look at. The style and tone of this story is what wins it for me every single time, because there's different acting performances. Visually, it's just a great story to look at, even in black and white, because the production team and the actors are working against the budget to make this story as entertaining for you as they can. This could have been done as a drab, in America we would say, Saturday morning kids live-action science fiction show a la Sid and Marty Krofft, and it could have been terrible acting and cheap sets. The people who made this story were magical in making this story as good as it is, not counting any defects in Jeffrey Orme's script. What you guys might not know is that there originally was backstory scripted for Professor Zaroff, and mm-hmm. that his wife and children had been killed in a car accident, and that's what makes him nuts. The production team was correct to drop that motivation and not even refer to it, because Zaroff only works as a mad scientist, as a sci-fi cliche mad scientist. He doesn't work as an actual human character who wants to destroy the world out of rage. That would have been a terrible idea. And Joseph First would have been hamstrung if that was the character he was playing. So I think we are lucky to lose that connection to the real world and just have a crazy, silly story in its own closed universe of crazy, silly people. So for me, Underwater Menace is not in my top 60. It's never going to match up with The Demons or The Gunfighters or Genesis of the Daleks or Mummy on the Orient Express.
Or The Dominators.
Or Heaven Sent, or any other story except that particular serial that Fraser just referred to. I think Underwater Menace is beautiful and gorgeous and it's fun. And if you don't like it, I don't think there's any reason to be a Doctor Who fan at all. I think it's a magical bit of work, even if it's terrible in spots. And the animation doesn't quite capture the genius of the surviving episodes 2 and 3. It's not as much fun as the animation. But the fact that we are getting it 56 years on, what other lost TV shows are still creating animations of lost episodes from so long ago? We are lucky in the Doctor Who world to even have this. So get the DVD, get the Blu-ray, watch every available version of the story, and find a way to enjoy it. I think it's all right there on the page. As we wrap up now, let's have a recommendation from each of you. What is something that you are currently watching now or reading now, Doctor Who or not Doctor Who related, that is giving you as much pleasure as Joseph First's performance as Professor Zaroff?
Well, I have just read the biography of David Whittaker by Simon Gurrier, which has been really fantastic. It's not that he had the most exciting of lives. That's certainly true. But the fact that Simon has managed to piece together the story of his life that we didn't know before this book was out, and he's done so much research, I think was an absolute joy to read. It was, real brilliance. And you come away with a real image of a man that we didn't know a lot about before this. And I thoroughly recommend searching out a copy of that. Really, really good. And his wider TV work and his time in Australia were really nicely sort of put together. So, yeah, great work from Simon Gurrier and highly recommended.
I also have the book. I am going to be at Gallifrey One with Simon next weekend. He is going to be coming up very soon on Doctor Who Literature, and I may repurpose some of that interview for Trap One if it goes on long enough. So I definitely second, third, and fourth size recommendation. Fraser, how about you? A recommendation of something that brings you joy in these troubled times, to quote Darren Mooney again.
I've got the David Whittaker book as well. I just haven't got around to reading it yet. Obviously, I hope that I'm going to be thoroughly enjoying Simon Hart's version of the episode 3 cliffhanger any minute now. But until then, I am currently reading Andrew Cartmell's memoir, Script Doctor, which covers his time as script editor from seasons. That's the one.
Jason had it 6 feet away from this keyboard.
Yep. For those of you who are watching us, Jason just held the book up. It's I think it feels as close as what we would get to Doctor Who Confidential of that era. You know, it's really quite a breakdown of story from script, from genesis of the script through to the final bit on the screen and everything that's going on in between with GNT and everything. So that's a fascinating read. I'm thoroughly enjoying that one and would recommend that highly to everyone, especially if, like me, that was your era, that was your time when you got into Doctor Who and became a fan.
As a corollary to that, I will point out that Andrew was recently a guest on Ian Martin's books podcast, Were All Stories in the End, talking about his first new adventure novel from 1992. Andrew is a wonderful interview guest. He has opinions. He has stories. He also talks a lot about his current line of fiction, the Vinyl Detective series. So even though that is not part of the Trap One universe, I highly recommend seeking out that podcast, We're All Stories in the End, and at least listening to the Andrew Cartmell interview about the Cat's Cradle Warhead book. For my part, obviously, I'm doing a lot of Doctor Who work right now for the Doctor Who Literature podcast. And I've got some really good guests coming up. And, of course, both of you guys are major parts of that show. In terms of non-Doctor Who material, I am currently binge-watching 2 episodes a night, the American science fiction soap from the late 60s, early 70s, Dark Shadows, which started off as a soap opera version of Jane Eyre, but when the ratings tanked, quickly became a sci-fi show with ghosts and vampires and witches. I just last night finished the first time travel arc in the show. In the spring of 1967, the show spent 90 episodes, actually 95 episodes, which in broadcast terms is almost five full months, going back from the 1960s to the 1790s to see the origin story of the show's vampire. And I just got to the end of that arc. I'm going to supplement that by watching the primetime 1991 remake of the show with an all-star cast, including Gene Simmons and Ben Cross. And that was a big-budget, lush adaptation of the same soap opera, but done as a primetime show. Unfortunately, it premiered the same week that the United States invaded Iraq and Kuwait in January of 1991, when CNN became the most watched network in the country. And the show could not compete with that, and the ratings went off of a cliff after the Gulf War started. And that was canceled and never renewed. But you can watch the surviving 12 episodes plus pilot movie on YouTube with ads. And I will be appearing on Drew Meyer's podcast, Who & Company, in a couple of weeks to discuss Doctor Who and Dark Shadows. Very enjoyable to watch, even though it's a soap opera, so you're making it five episodes a week, and a lot of episodes are filler, and not every cast member's in every episode. Some of the dramatic turns in this self-contained 1795 story arc are just white-knuckle rides, even though you're watching a show that is as old as The Underwater Menace, and in color. You can find that on most of your streaming platforms of choice. In the States, I'm watching it on Tubi. I think it's also available on Amazon and a few other places. So that is my recommendation for the week. You can find me, of course, on Doctor Who Literature, where Cy and Fraser are frequent guests. Quickly, where else can we find you fellows on the internet?
Well, you can hear me on my own podcast now, The Library of Impossible Things, where Fraser has been a guest and Jason will be a guest at some point. Hopefully we will sort that out, and where you can hear the story of fans and their love of the show and how much it means to them, which is going very well. Otherwise, you can find me. I'm still clinging on to Twitter at the moment, as @Cy_Hart, and you can find me as @Cy_Hart on Blue Sky.
Well, when I'm not swimming around harvesting plankton to feed everyone within a couple of hours, you will also find me on Twitter as @FelixFraser, all one word, Fraser spelled with a Z. Same on Blue Sky. Podcast-wise, you'll find me wherever anyone will have me, which also includes More Trap Ones, Doctor Who Literature, Library Impossible Things, and most often than not, a hamster with a blunt penknife.
You can find me on Blue Sky and YouTube at Doctor Who Novels. You can find Doctor Who Literature on your podcast of choice, podcatcher of choice. You can find Trap One at @Trap1_ on Twitter. We are on Blue Sky as well. You can find the Trap One podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. Dip into our back catalog. Next week, a different panel of Trap One hosts and guests will cover a different topic from the world of Doctor Who and Doctor Who merchandise. But as we close for the night, take us home, Cy, with your performance of the Episode 3 cliffhanger.
Your people? Your people? They are my people now. I hold their whole world in my power. You're a fool. You're a fool! I'll send you to your beloved goddess Amdo to discuss the future of the universe with her. You? You demand? You demand? Well, since your beloved goddess has developed such an enchanting appetite for people, it is only fitting that the great Faust should offer himself. No. No. I shall offer him. Kill those two men. Nothing in the world can stop me now!
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Cy Hart.